saving money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 26 colors of Owens Corning Duration shingles and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Specifically, one of tonight's stories revolves around the events following a suicide. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your illustrious host and narrator, and tonight I'd like to present a new author to the show, L.P. Hernandez. We're featuring three of Mr. Hernandez's stories tonight, all of which are available in his collection Dreadful, Tales of the Dead and Dying, and I've got a link in the text here for your convenience. To begin, good strawberries prove a little too tempting for a member of the Fae. Then, in madness, a man finds just how easily a human mind can break when some basic rules are changed. And then finally, in Gehenna, a young man working a graveyard shift finds his isolation deepening into something more unexpected and dangerous. It's like a triple scoop of horror ice cream. Let's dig in. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author L.P. Hernandez, I give you Good Strawberries. I grew into a man at the age of 11 in August 1942. I can remember the colors of that summer and the sounds. It began with the promise of new life and victory. We listened to the man on the radio talk about the war, how the Japanese and the Nazis were whipping our hides at both ends. Daddy was one of a handful of men left in the country because Mama wouldn't let him go. The reports weighed on him, and there was an unspoken tension between my parents each evening. That beautiful golden string that connected them was taut and frayed. A broadcast would come on about 1,000 men dead in France, and Daddy would look at Mama with this longing in his eyes. We lived on a farm, but Daddy was a mechanic, and business had been slow. Not a lot of vehicles on the road, and so not much to repair. We had no crops but a garden, no livestock but a few cattle. Daddy figured he was more useful to the nation as a soldier than to us as a mechanic. Mama was 6 months along when Daddy left in the spring of 1942. Mama hadn't been part of the decision, but she spent almost every minute of every day by the radio listening to the newsmen. Daddy wanted to fight Hitler, but he was sent to the Orient to fight Japanese. We got a couple of letters from him while he was in training. Mama cried over hers so much they nearly fell apart. But anyway, this is my story about the strawberry thief with the green hat, and I promise I'll get to him. My brother, Stuart, was born in the middle of May, just a couple of weeks before school let out. I remember the birth, too. Ms. Johnston lived down the road a couple miles, and she and Mama were friends. She'd birthed a couple of babies in her time, especially for the folks that couldn't afford the hospital, which was most of the people we associated with. I remember my mama crying and cussing and yelling my daddy's name. It seemed like it took forever, and I was too tired to go to school the next day. And Stuart came out with a full head of hair, too. I remember those green eyes, how they seemed too big for his face. And he had such a grip, as if he was born to turn a wrench. I had seen the thief before, in the meadow once, and another time he was fishing at our pond, but I almost always saw him in the garden. Mama never understood why we never had any strawberries, and I gave up trying to tell her about the thief in the green hat. He loved strawberries. I don't think I ever saw him take anything else. I was around 7 years old the first time I saw him. It must have been early in the summer, because I remember all the blue bonnets, how the wind could make them dance around my knees. I heard him, before I saw him, singing in a language I could not place. Not that I'd been exposed to much beyond the English and Spanish spoken in the Texas hill country. I followed the song and saw the tip of a hat bobbing in and out of view. It was green, pointed, and looked like felt or something similar. His voice was gravelly and rather high-pitched. He might have stood a head taller than my knee. He skipped in the direction of the pond, or so I thought. The blue bonnets gave way to shorter grass, and it was then I finally saw him clearly from behind. He was tiny, but proportional. Shirt blue, pants brown. His boots were the same shade of green as his hat, which was about half as tall as his body. There was a satchel on his back, brimming with strawberries. It was early for strawberries, so the ones he stole were on the small side. He jumped around a rabbit hole and some of the berries fell to the ground. He stopped singing and turned to gather his fallen treasure. And that's when he saw me, and I saw his face for the first time. It was like a man's, but different in a way I've never fully understood. Maybe because the rest of him was so small. My mind struggled to make sense of the combination. If I put his age in human years, I would estimate he was in his late 40s. However, he moved like a much younger man. I will never forget his eyes. A shade of yellow I've never before seen on a living thing, like sunlight trapped in a marble. He saw me, and we both stopped. Was I predator or prey? I did not know.
"You've got strawberries," he said.
"Good strawberries?" I asked. He nodded, retrieved his prize, and sprinted away. He scrambled like a squirrel with a cat on its heels, and I couldn't keep up. Thought he was going to jump into the pond, but at the last second, he veered right and disappeared into the old oak tree. Mama didn't believe any of it, but Daddy loved to hear my stories. As time passed, I began to embellish them, I suppose, as any kid would. Stuart was a good baby. He hardly cried at all, but Mama didn't seem to notice him or anything else. Nowadays, they call it postpartum depression, but back then, a tired Mama wasn't worth studying. Daddy hadn't sent a letter, and it would be a few months before we learned why. He had died in the Pacific, on or near some island called Guam. But that summer was full of hope, that we'd win the war, Daddy would come home, and Mama would stop crying. Mama was so sad all the time, I started raising Stuart myself, as best I knew how. She fed him, but I could see in her eyes that she hadn't learned to love him. When he cried to be changed, she just turned the radio up louder, weeping as reports came in about the dead. Daddy was probably already dead by that time, and maybe she felt it. I saw him one time that summer before it happened. My story, that is. Only a few strawberries had come in, and he was running away from the garden toward the bluebonnet meadow with an empty satchel. Perhaps his disappointment at not finding strawberries had something to do with the fact that this was the first time I'd not heard him singing. I spent a lot of time with Stuart, reading him the same books over and over, taking him for walks outside. Sometimes I would sneak Clark, our dog, into the house so Stuart could see him. I think Stuart liked that too, because his eyes always got so big when he saw that dog. He'd laugh and hold out his arms like he wanted a hug. It was toward the end of July, the night it happened. School was still a month or so off, and that was just fine by me. Mama was basically a ghost by then, but I had Stuart. I remember waking up and staring at the moonlight on the floor, the shape of the shadows on the ground. Thinking on it now, I can feel the breeze coming through my window, cooled my exposed skin, while the rest of my body was somewhat sweaty beneath my sheets. There were no crickets chirping, which I found strange, but there was another sound which was familiar to me. It was singing, the same happy tune I'd heard half a dozen times before. I was so tired, not in my mind, but in my body. It was like there was a weight on me, as if the voice was made of iron and it was holding me fast to my bed. I heard Stuart cry, a sound I recognized was from agitation and usually meant he needed to be changed. I managed to lift my head a few inches, but the weight forced me down again. Stuart's cries were louder, more urgent. New voices accompanied the singing. I was able to grasp the windowsill and pull myself up as the singing and crying mingled together, and it seemed to be coming from outside. I rested my chin on the sill and looked out the window. The strawberry thief was pulling a wagon behind him, skipping away into the meadow. I could not summon the energy to do anything, to cry out even. I could not save him. Stuart was in the wagon, wailing as he was stolen away from me. I woke the next day in a panic. The memory of the night before was hazy and would not regain clarity for years. There was a baby crying, and the fear I had about Stuart having been taken in the night faded away as my grogginess did. Even as I followed the cries, though, I knew there was something different about them. There was a harsh edge to the wail, something I'd never heard from Stuart. The baby in the crib was not Stuart, and did not look human at all. Its head was large and not symmetrical, like a melted light bulb. Where my brother had a mop of brown hair, this thing had pale wisps, white if they were any color at all. Its eyes were almond-shaped and angled upwards, but worst of all was its mouth. Its teeth, and Stuart had only a couple of those by then, were like broken rocks, and there was no logic to them. Its skin was translucent to an extent, and I can still recall the sight of its little heart beating. It hardly moved, but its cries filled the room, as if it was resting on broken glass instead of a blanket. How could such a tiny thing make such a noise? When it screamed, I felt as though my teeth would shatter right inside my mouth. It stole the breath from my lungs. Mama didn't notice any difference. She just sat closer to the radio to hear the newsman better. She tried to nurse the thing once, that first day. She screamed, and it did too. She left him on the floor of the living room and hid in her bedroom for the rest of the day. There was a trail of blood droplets beginning at her chair and continuing through the hall. Mom came out once that evening to make dinner. I tried to talk to her, to tell her about the singing in the night and how the thing sleeping at the crib was not Stuart. But if she understood me, she made no indication to that effect. That was the first day with the thing that was not Stuart. As small as the thing was, it seemed to grow smaller. Mama would not allow it to feed, and it would not swallow anything I offered. Everything I placed in its mouth would leak out the sides, pool in the hollows of its cheeks or trickle into its ears, and it only stopped screaming when it slept, which it did, thankfully, for most of the day. It produced no waste, but I left it in a diaper because the sight of its genitals was so disturbing. It was obviously male, but the gnarled appendage between its legs looked burnt and tacked on, like it didn't belong to the body, but was added at the last second.
Saving money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 26 colors of Owens Corning Duration shingles and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
When the men came with a letter about Daddy, I kept it to myself. Mom was sleeping through most of the day, and I could not think of a worse reason to wake her. I thought it was better for Mama to have hope. That was all she had by then. But I didn't have Stuart, and I didn't know what to do about it. I tried to treat the thing like Stuart, but I couldn't. I hated it. Mama and Clark hated it too. After a week or so, I was sure the thing was going to die, and I secretly hoped that it would. It never ate, ever. It was barely strong enough to move its arms and legs and couldn't lift its head, which seemed to swell as its body withered. It cried throughout the night, but over the course of days, the screams became mewling, so soft I could no longer hear them. When it mewled, I felt pity for it. I missed Stuart, but the thing was so helpless, so pathetic. How could I not feel something? One morning, I woke and heard what sounded like cooing, like normal baby babbling, and I thought at once that Stuart had returned. I rushed to Stuart's room and walked into a massacre. A streak of blood trailed from the crib, through the room and down the hallway to the open front door. The thing was engorged, its heart beating fiercely, which I could see through its opaque skin. It was healthy and happy for the first time. I followed the blood to the porch, where I found a crimson pelt and an assortment of bones. That was all that was left of my dog, matted fur and bones. I stood there for a while, the rage building inside while I looked at the remains, only carrion then, and host to about a million flies. I did not know how the thing that was not Stuart could kill a 70-pound dog when it couldn't lift its own head. I didn't know why the dog's likely howls did not wake me or Mama. I returned to the crib with a knife in my hand. I hovered above the crib and stared at it. Its teeth were stained brown from blood, and I recognized the vigor in its eyes as the same liveliness I'd seen in the little fellow with the green hat. I left the thing in the cradle and stayed outside most of the day, walking through the meadow, which had lost most of its flowers to the summer heat. My hatred had not lessened in the hours that passed since finding the remains of my dog on the porch. I'd lost everything that August. My father was dead, my brother missing, my dog dead, and Mama was as good as dead. Though I didn't know if my brother was dead, I had to hope that he wasn't. I had to hope for something. At home, Mama was cleaning the blood in the hallway. I started to speak to her, but recognized the vacancy in her eyes. She was lost in her own mind. A world in which her husband had not left to die in some jungle half a world away. I found the killed in action letter crumpled on the kitchen table. I wondered if Mama even understood what the words meant. Did she know her husband was never coming home? A few nights later, I woke and found myself unable to move again. I heard screams, terrible screams choked with blood. They were an animal's screams, and although I was familiar with the sounds of any animal on four legs in that slice of Texas, I could not place it. I fought against the paralysis but couldn't move an inch, and so I listened to the screams that gradually died away, and then the sound of feeding. I listened until I slept, and the sounds became part of my nightmares. I could not make sense of the remains on the porch, but it was bigger than Clark. A boar, maybe. As summer was nearing its end, my life slipped into a horrible cycle. Every couple of days, I woke to the sound of screams. Sometimes there were animal parts on the porch, and sometimes there was just blood. One night, toward the end of August, I woke in such a way that left me no choice but to respond. Gravelly, high-pitched singing wafted through the open window as I woke, probably after midnight. It was the same song as before, the strange words sometimes rhyming and sometimes not, but that was not my immediate concern. Beneath the singing, but much closer to my person, was the sound of a muffled mewling. I felt the weight of the thing's head on my chest, and its frail arm like a vice around my midsection. And once again, I was unable to move. Its tiny hand felt like a dull blade prodding my ribs, and I could not move. I smelled blood and felt wetness on my bare chest as the thing whined and smacked its lips. It was responding to the song from outside, the strawberry thief filling his satchel with the fruits of my labor. His voice faded until the sound of the thing that was not Stuart breathing on my chest was the loudest sound in the room. I do not recall falling asleep, but did at some point. In the morning, I woke with dried blood and slaver crusted on my skin. Daddy taught me how to set traps for rabbits. Mama once said if I caught one, she'd make rabbit stew with pie for dessert that very day. I tried for months with little success until the year before he left for war. I came home from school and left my books at the door so I could check the three snares I'd set. The first was empty, but the second was not. I spied the animal, a young brown jackrabbit, from behind. It twitched, pulled, and strained against the thin wire eaten into its flesh. It gnawed at the paw and drew blood. Rabbit stew lost its appeal at that moment. The animal went wild as I neared, bucking like the bulls at the rodeo. I pinned him to the ground by the neck and released him from the trap, after some struggling. The rabbit limped away and left small puddles of blood behind. And I found it a few days later, dead beneath a weeping willow, deflated like an old shirt fallen from the laundry basket. I picked through the strawberries, leaving the biggest on a particular patch where I laid my snare. Then, I could only wait. Two nights later, I woke to two different sounds. I recognized the sound of the thing that was not Stuart snoring in its room, a sound that steadied my heart. The other sound was an angry, spit-filled voice. Rather than risk waking either Mama or the snoring thing, I crawled out of my open window and landed outside. Despite its agitated state, the voice was familiar. The thief was caught in the snare and fighting with all of his strength. "Where's my brother?" I asked. The little creature locked his strange eyes on mine as his little teeth glistened in the moonlight. In the years between that night and today, I've come across portrayals of creatures that shared some physical similarities, gremlins and medieval paintings of devils, small, vicious beings. His silver beard was a mismatch to the cotton-colored hair on his head, which had previously been tucked inside his green hat, then on the dirt. Never taking his eyes off me, he struggled to reach something nearby. I kneeled and patted the area that interested him, finding a smooth little stick. He screamed when I took it and fought harder against the snare. "Where is my brother?" He snapped and bit, spittle flying. I brandished the smooth stick. It was only a few inches long and narrowed to a blunted point, hardly intimidating. But he was terrified of it. I aimed it at him and he hid his face behind his hands.
"Brother in the tree."
"My brother's in the tree." He nodded. "What does that mean?"
"Dem witch took him. Dem took him to the tree and gon' keep him."
What's that thing in Stuart's room? He lunged and yelled from the pain of the snare biting into his ankle. The anger began to build in me, to fill my body. I felt the smooth stick warm in my hand, and it shook, vibrated some. It glowed from the base, and a little spark shot out of the tip. The spark exploded with a brief popping sound when it contacted the earth. The thing, I hesitate to call him a man, and I stared at each other for a moment that seemed like a long time, but probably wasn't. The hatred in his eyes was intense. "You want this back?" He spit at me. "I want my brother back, and I want you to take that thing away." He dropped his head at this point, tired from fighting.
"Damn, witch not give him to me."
The hatred bled from his eyes, and in its place was a sort of helpless calm. In the silence afterward, I could hear the thing that was not Stuart bleeding in its crib like a lost calf. The strawberry thief did not look about to speak anytime soon. I did the only thing I could at that time. I bribed him. I cut the snare and pointed the stick at him like a gun. He held his hands up and sort of slinked away toward the house. A few minutes passed, and I waited outside, firing off sparks with the stick. The front door finally opened, and there was the strawberry thief, ferrying the strange, crying baby on his back. He threw something at my feet and said,
"That his. Keep it deaf, you want."
It was about the size of a toothpick and as smooth as the stick I held in my right hand. We walked into the night together. The thing that was not Stuart fell asleep, but it roused a bit as the thief tripped over rocks and around holes. We walked through the empty meadow toward the pond, this time unaccompanied by song. He stopped at the tree and turned, the strange architecture of his face pulling into a mask of hesitation. The baby on his back could not have weighed 10 pounds, but it seemed to bend him in half.
"Give me a bit of time," he told me.
He disappeared inside of the tree with the baby on his back and left me there in the dark. The minutes that followed were the longest of my life. I wondered if he might appear with 100 of his kind, little ones with smooth sticks. Or, even worse, what if he'd sent the witches after me? A few crickets gave me company during those minutes, but things were otherwise silent. The thief appeared, holding Stuart underneath his armpits. Stuart was asleep, and I was not sure how, considering how much he was being jostled about. He passed Stuart to me, and I propped him on my hip, surprised at his weight. "We have a deal?" He nodded and adjusted the new green hat on his head. The other was still amid the strawberries. I handed him his stick, and he smiled, running his fingers along its smooth grain. There was a second where he thought he might point the stick at me, but he didn't. He turned and ran into the tree, vanishing. It's surprising how quickly life returns to normal after an experience like that. Stuart grew into a normal child and a smart man. I did time in Korea while Stuart went to school. But for the first few months, things were strange. Stuart was about the size of a 2-year-old when I reclaimed him and already talking. On paper, he was not even 6 months old, but he had the confidence of a toddler. He didn't speak English, though, and it took a year to set him right. Mama came around by Christmas. I think she knew more than she let on. I made good on my end of the deal, too. I didn't see the thief as much after that night, and only a few times as an adult. Now and then, I found him fishing, but more often than not, he was gathering strawberries from the patch I planted all around the tree. Sometimes, I sleep with the window open, and I swear I can still hear him singing. You've been listening to Good Strawberries by L.P. Hernandez. Next, here's Madness, also by L.P. Hernandez. Number 5231985. There are fates worse than death. There are fates worse than hell, even. My head swam freely, nonsensically in my final moments. As the torrent of blood yielded a slow gurgle, my tireless heart beating on adrenaline and instinct. Senses dissipated one by one. The side of the bathroom tiles became a shapeless white wall. And then nothing. The sound of rushing water gave way to a drone replaced by emptiness. In those final moments of cognizance, I might have hoped to see something beautiful in my mind, a final private goodbye from a world too liberal with its cruelty. Perhaps the memory of a puppy's warmth in my child-sized hands, of being tucked into bed with my mother's hum in my ears. I yearned for white light, not caring if it led me to heaven as long as it led me away from that life. My brain, lacking blood and oxygen, fired at random instead. The last thought that dwelled in my waking mind was that of a saying I'd heard years before. I'm not able to recall the precise wording, nor am I in a position to research it. However, there is a theory that, given an infinite amount of time, a monkey seated at a typewriter and striking keys at random would eventually type out the entire works of Shakespeare. As my heart relaxed for the first time in its 28 years, I saw an image in my dying mind of a chimpanzee, not a monkey precisely, at a typewriter. Not what I expected, but not cruel. I cannot account for the time that passed between my death and the sudden realization that I was walking. I followed a man wearing a black suit. His hair was black as well, not styled, but parted towards the right as if scooped that way with his hand rather than a comb. Together, we walked down a white corridor with doors on either side at regular intervals of around 8 feet. His steps were quick and deliberate. Though I stood half a foot taller than him, I had to jog to keep pace. "Where are we?" I asked, assuming by his stern countenance that he was in charge. He might have grunted in response. I can't really trust my memories. After a few more silent steps, he stopped before a door that, in appearance, was no different from its neighbors. He opened the door and faced me, inviting me to enter with a smile that looked like a fresh scar on his face. I did as he wished and walked into the room, taking about 3 steps before stopping when I realized he had not followed. The man, and his face is only a blur in my mind now, grabbed the doorknob. I do not trust my memory in one respect. I recall the words he spoke, although the texture of his voice is lost to me. "The complete works. When you're done, you may move on," he said. He closed the door. There was no sound of a lock engaged, but I soon found the knob to be rigid and unmoving. While gripping the knob, I noticed my wrist was healed. There was a faint white line that would have been imperceptible had I not been looking for it. Although I recalled the wound, the sudden image of my arm stained red, I did not associate it with my death. I then surveyed my body and found that I was clothed in a tunic of sorts, an outfit comprised of a single piece of white fabric. The room was white as well, but there was no identifiable light source. I walked forward, my footfalls like a cat on carpet. I walked for 10 seconds or so before I stretched my arms out in front of my body, preparing to contact a wall. I am still searching for that wall. After walking and then jogging for 50, then 100 feet, I stopped and turned around. The door should have appeared smaller in my vision, but it did not. Seeing no other option, I returned to examine the only feature of the room, the desk with the typewriter on it. The desk was white and the typewriter black. The seat was white, angular, and stiff, the kind of chair that stored for 99% of its life and only brought out during an assembly. I ran my hand over both the desk and the chair and found my sense of feeling was dull. It was almost as if there was nothing beneath my fingers. I'm not sure what material these objects are made from, but they feel slightly warm at all times. I sat before the typewriter and hit a key, and then another. "Hi" appeared on the page already spooled into the device. I realized I had not seen a source of paper and so looked beneath the desk. There was not a stack, as I would have expected. The paper emitted from the floor itself. On my hands and knees, I brought my eyes to within an inch of what I assumed would be a gap in the floor. But there was no gap. The paper would not rip either. I returned to my seat and typed a bit more. The quick brown fox. That sentence stirred something in my mind, a recollection. I imagined a chimpanzee seated at a typewriter. My mind strained to make a connection, but failed in that moment. "Hello?" I said. To my own ears, my voice sounded small and distant. I recalled the corridor, the man, and the doors that extended to the limits of my sight. I left the desk for a moment and walked forward in the same fashion as before, my arms extended like a mummy in a Scooby-Doo cartoon. I walked about 6 feet, the desk only about the length of my body away from me. Before returning to the desk, I walked the 6 paces to the door and seized the knob again. With my teeth gritted, I turned and felt my bloodless hands slide over its featureless surface. I sat at the desk again. "My name is John." I had used typewriters before, and this one functioned well. There was a nice springiness to the keys, yet it was whisper quiet. As I considered the mechanics of the device, I recalled the words from the man in the hallway. "The complete works. When you're done, you may move on." I made the connection, slowly at first, to the seemingly random thought of a chimpanzee typing. I did not immediately remember why I died, but only that it was so. I recalled the dulling of my senses and my disappointment at not reliving a cherished memory. I saw the chimpanzee again. My last thought in life. The complete works. Move on to where? I thought about Shakespeare and realized at once that I only had a passing knowledge of his writing. I read some works in their entirety when it was required of me and enjoyed them, but for every play I had read, there were probably 2 that I had not. Romeo and Juliet. I typed those words and then reclined in the chair again with my hands clasped atop my sternum. Beneath the base of my palms, I detected no heartbeat. I searched my neck with 2 fingers for the carotid artery. There was no pulse. Was I still dead? Was I in a coma? Perhaps my mother had come over for a visit and found my body nearly lifeless in the tub. I did not care if I had lived or died, but only wished that I was not seated at that typewriter with the words of the man in the black suit swirling in my mind. I waited. There are many ways to tell time, the modern conveniences I took for granted to the passing of the sun overhead, light and darkness, the changing of the seasons, hunger, fatigue. I had access to none of those. I had no heartbeat to serve as a metronome. I was not hungry and felt no desire for sleep. I had nothing, not even the regularity of breathing, as I soon learned that I no longer needed oxygen. What felt like hours, but could well have been minutes, passed in absolute silence. I breathed because it comforted me, not because I needed it. I sang because my rebellious mind was making frightening connections. I began to type because of a lack of alternatives. I did not attempt Shakespeare, however. My mind was not committed to the fact that Shakespeare was my fate. Instead, I wrote about what brought me to the bathtub a minute, day, or 1,000 years prior. When I finished, the manuscript overflowed the desk but found its way to the same non-existent slot from which the paper originated. As I typed, new paper came up through the floor, the desk, and the typewriter. What I wrote eventually found its way back into the same slot. I do not understand how it functions, but nothing has changed since that time. I also realized that I could not write to entertain myself, as the paper always disappeared into the floor. I could read the equivalent of about 7 pages before it was consumed. I tried the doorknob again. I found the chair to be indestructible, as well as the desk and typewriter. My body, likewise, was unbreakable. I punched the typewriter and only managed to depress a few keys. I felt no pain and found that not even an indentation of the circular keys was left in my skin. A quick slap to my face was like a plastic prosthesis contacting numb flesh. I returned to the desk and began to type. How long since the man in the hallway? An hour? A day? Shakespeare was not on my radar. The thought of those thousands of pages was too vast. I wrote about good things, pleasant things. Even in a terrible life, there are moments of joy. I wrote about these things because of a pale, unacknowledged voice inside me that suggested I might be here for a while. I wrote because I did not want to forget. I described my mother's face. In the final years of my life, it was in a state of worry more often than not, the genuine smile collapsing over time into a rigid grin. I wrote about a dog I had loved, only to recall holding her black and white paw as the drugs took effect. I wrote about the first movie I ever saw in the theater, about a Little League game in which I was the hero. I filled the endless pages with memories, and they disappeared into the floor. But the simple act of writing kept them alive in my mind. Reliving joy, it was not possible to feel confident in the decisions that led me to the bathtub. Had I really wanted it, or was I trying to spread my pain to others? It was too heavy to consider. The weight of my decisions rested on my shoulders like the burden of Atlas. Days passed. They must have. The doorknob was my greatest enemy and my only source of hope. Each time I grasped it with a flutter in my chest. This time, it would give. Like a beaten dog approaching his master's hand, my hope sparked, regardless of the reality. I ran miles into nothingness, never feeling out of breath and never breaking a sweat. With a marathon's distance behind me, I turned and saw the desk as it was, the paper filled with the story I began but would never finish. The typewriter was silent, waiting. I both hated the typewriter and loved it. I believe months passed before I sat at the desk and attempted the impossible. Romeo and Juliet. Romeo, wherefore art thou? I did not know the first line of Romeo and Juliet, and it was Shakespeare's work I knew best. I wrote the outline of the story as best I could remember, pausing many times to walk away, sometimes for what felt like days. I yelled and screamed and clawed at my own skin. My screams were dull in my ears, as if my lungs were full of cotton, and my fingernails left behind not a blemish. Madness. I would have preferred madness to the tyranny of reason. I understood my plight, and so knew it was impossible. If I typed Shakespeare's works in their entirety and spelled Mercutio with a second T, I might never know my error. I might miss a comma. Or did commas not matter? Where did the paper go? And who was analyzing it? Was it Henry V or Henry VIII? The fine line extending from my wrist to the middle of my forearm mocked me. The memory of the warm, vermilion flow never left my thoughts. The memories preceding the decision, the memories that made it necessary, were not as clear. I typed at random, never looking at the keys, for days into weeks, for months. Far worse than hell is the fruitless hope of salvation. The doorknob. The fucking doorknob. Religion never factored into my musings. Put me to work breaking rocks in hell, or whatever they do there, as long as it was not a typewriter. The mind cannot comprehend infinity. It's one of the few things I've learned here. With nothing but time to consider it, I'm no closer to understanding. Trillions multiplied by trillions of years might be a fraction of my sentence. Though I did not know where I was, what plane of existence, I refused to accept that it was unending. I fantasized about hot lashes across my back, in that place where I could take residence among the damned. I longed for nothingness, to be broken down into elements and dispersed throughout the universe without a memory of the white room and the typewriter. Worse than pain is the knowledge that pain will never come. Healing after the pain would never come. I battered the doorknob, but my fingers might as well have been putty. How many words had Shakespeare written? Thousands upon millions? What chance did I have? Then again, what choice did I have? I walked into the endless expanse of white nothingness for longer than I had lived on Earth. I forgot my mother's face. When I realized this, I knew she had been dead for years, decades more likely. And through it all, my sanity did not waver. I was coherent and aware of my fate at all times. I've not slept in hundreds of years. My waking dreams are fleeting and untrustworthy. Ask for me tomorrow, and you will find me a grave man. I wish for nothing more. I've typed billions of words on this damned typewriter, and will type billions more. However, I am through trying. I have written the bulk of Shakespeare's words, though not in the proper order. I will not try again. When the earth is consumed by its life-giving star, I will be here, typing. When that star expels its matter across the Milky Way, I will be here, typing. When that matter begins to collect and condense and become the seed of life again, I will be here, in this white room, typing. Until there is nothing, finally, when the cycle of death and rebirth ends, I will be here. Parting is such sweet sorrow. He paused for a moment and looked at the doorknob. Number 5231986. There are fates worse than death. There are fates worse than hell, even. You've just heard Madness by L.P. Hernandez. Finally, to close out our evening, I present Gehenna by L.P. Hernandez. In a word, Andy felt detached. In the beginning, it was a blessing. Working the night shift eliminated his need to interact with friends and family. His mother stopped calling to tell him about his abuela's perpetually deteriorating condition. Her descriptions were often graphic and always ended with heavy, stuttering sobs. As far as Andy was concerned, his abuela was a cruel and vile woman when in good health, and the thought of her withering body, to him, was like a pebble tossed into the ocean. His friends stopped inviting him out to parties. That was okay, one less place to feel awkward. Social obligations dried like grapes left on the vine until none were left. The solitude was a gift, allowing time for introspection and quiet contemplation. The job, however, was supposed to be temporary. Months piled on top of each other until they became a year, then two. By the third year, Andy was detached. Solitude dissolved into isolation. He returned from work and sat in his living room, stirring the cool, soggy chunks of mystery meat within his TV dinner. He'd stare at the television, the wall, or nothing in particular, with dewy, red-rimmed eyes. Food didn't even taste like food. It tasted like a color. Gray. There was nothing to distinguish a given day from the one that preceded it. Andy was a walking husk, an animated ghost roaming the boxy labyrinth of his apartment, the walls bare save for the shit paint-patching jobs masking the nail holes of prior tenants. Andy belonged to the other world, the one of insomniac automatons that kept the gears grinding while most everyone else slept. It was the moth that changed everything. his nocturnal brother, who'd become lost on his way to the beacon of the bedside lamp, and slept. Andy navigated his room, shuffling items here and there as he prepared to sleep. He paid little attention to the previous night's edition of The Late Show on the television. The sound of muted laughter was enough to inspire some response, arched eyebrows or a smile a psychiatrist might offer a pedophile. Nothing registered. Had Mr. Colbert placed a gun to his temple and painted his studio with gore and gray matter, Andy would not have responded any differently. He brushed his teeth in the dark and avoided his reflection while doing so. Andy had unintentionally grown a beard over the course of the few months leading up to that night. In quick glimpses, he found his appearance gaunt, though the scale claimed his weight had not fluctuated more than a few pounds since receiving his driver's license at 16. More than gaunt, he looked drained, not necessarily of fat or muscle, but of the persistence that ping-ponged him off of life's old disappointments. Shaving reminded him of everything he had never become, so he stopped. Andy glanced at the television to find Stephen Colbert frozen in midair. It appeared the host had been prancing toward his guest in the interview segment of the show when the broadcast faltered. Wearing only flannel pajama bottoms, Andy stalked around his bedroom in search of the remote. He was not wholly concerned with Mr. Colbert or his guest, but the idea of not knowing where the remote was needled him in a very specific way. It was a strange fixation carried over from his childhood. Had the moth not been flying at eye level, Andy might not have noticed it. The frayed edge of one shale-colored wing grazed Andy's cheek as he walked past. His heart very nearly lodged in his throat, and the excited yelps he emitted did not resemble any modern language, but seemed a collection of unrelated syllables. His fingertips sought the tingling flesh of his cheek while he searched for the source of the surprise. He saw the moth, paused in mid-flight a few feet shy of the lamp. Its wings were blurred along their edges as if it was a photograph of a moth instead of the actual insect. He examined it from inches away, looking for a string or thread to explain its defiance of gravity. "What?" he whispered, and even in that softly spoken word, his voice managed to crack. He glanced at the television, the two-dimensional form of Stephen Colbert replicating the moth's violation of physics. There was no circulation of air within the room. It was the stillness of the pharaoh's tombs, the quiet of forgotten cemeteries. Ideas blossomed and expired in an instant, and none took root. He raised a quivering hand and brought it near the moth, licking his lips, his whole body like a bowstring drawn to its limit. His trembling index finger grazed a wing, and he recoiled at once. Something passed between him and the moth, a jolt not unlike the shock of discharged static electricity. Stephen Colbert landed, to applause like rainfall on a metal roof, nearly inaudible, and the moth fluttered the remaining feet to the lampshade. Its shadowed form loomed large on the ceiling. The supermarket sacrificed quality and customer satisfaction to eliminate three positions within its bakery, choosing frozen dough over its popular handmade bread. The crew of overnight bakers was whittled from four down to just one, Andy, who tended the donut fryer. The bakery manager attempted to switch to frozen donuts, which would have eliminated Andy's position, but the customer uproar over the first pitiful batch resulted in a raise for Andy, as well as guaranteed hours. He worked alone, ears plugged with audiobooks, and clocked out as the day shift arrived. His co-workers knew him by his name on the schedule, his initials next to a timestamp on a label of dough in the cooler, but few could say they knew him. He left early when possible, sunglasses shielding sore eyes even in the darkness of the parking lot. Andy went days without speaking to anyone, and was often shocked at the sound of his own voice on the occasions a casual conversation could not be avoided. His voice had the timid quality of an immigrant attempting to communicate in his non-native tongue, each word a trial. He was detached, hovering on the fringes of society, exhausted and alone. Andy encountered little traffic on the drive from the supermarket to his apartment. On the humid August morning following the night of the moth, Andy drove the familiar route beneath the milky orange glow of street lamps, windshield fogging despite his best attempts to clear it. The radio was low, tuned to a crackling AM station alternating between college football chatter and classical music. Andy's aching eyes squinted, and sweat traced the crest of his brow as he cursed the air conditioning, which was only cool when he didn't think about it. His headlights washed over a homeless man attempting his best impression of a statue behind a shopping cart overflowing with bulging garbage bags. Andy slowed and merged into the left lane. He rolled down the window. "Sir," he said, the first word he'd spoken to another soul in 2 days. "Sir?" as a question. Andy held out money, yet his audience of one was unimpressed. The man was trapped in a swath of darkness between the circular borders of light drizzled by the lamppost overhead. He was anonymous in everything but gender, which was revealed by shaggy tufts of white hair between the first and second knuckles. Andy released the money, and it fell on unseen waves like a feather. "Oh, well," he whispered, and turned his gaze to the road. The car did not respond to his initial demand to accelerate. As he became aware of that unusual circumstance, the pedal eventually being pressed to the floorboard with no response, he also recognized a hum from within the vehicle. The hum was musical and did not waver in pitch, volume, or consistency. It came from the speakers, a solitary trumpet note singing in the stillness of the approaching dawn. Andy vacated the vehicle, at once recalling the moth suspended in flight. The light above revealed a collection of moths similarly afflicted, within perpetual reach of their ultimate goal, yet growing no closer. The world around was a snapshot, a perfect, unwavering offering of a sliver of time. "Hey!" he shouted. The word expired as it passed his lips and sounded as though it was screamed into a pillow. His attention returned to the man in the shadows. This was not an ode to statues, but a living one. Possibly living. Andy examined him from all sides, but the darkness was thorough. He brought his face to within an inch of the man, detecting no odor, and saw not a flutter, not even a hint of movement. Proximity did not affect the darkness, as only the suggestion of contours was tenable. Had the incident with the moth lasted as long? Andy backed away, feeling as if he was breathing the last of the oxygen left in the frozen world. His hand searched his throat and lingered near his sternum. His heart responded to the surge of adrenaline, a chorus of monkey-fisted hailstones threatening to shatter the skeletal bonds from within. What if there was no return? Movement from the opposite side of the street. It appeared injured, perambulating on two legs in a slow, deliberate manner, its spindly arms flailing awkwardly as if perpetually off balance. Andy thought nothing, but merely watched. The creature's head was the approximate length of its body, yet its girth was impossible. It moved from shadow to light as it crossed the street, stopping at the curb, which came up to its knees. The head remained on the asphalt, a glistening streak painting the road leading up to it. Though at a distance of 50 or so feet, Andy recognized human-like features he'd never before seen on a person. Fleshy, pulsing caverns occupied the space beneath its brow, and the line running from ear to ear opened at regular intervals to reveal an array of dry, grinding teeth. In some ways, the face resembled a child's drawing, without symmetry and possessing merely the rudimentary essence of standard anatomy. It caressed the concrete curb with its thin, bulb-tipped fingers, while its head remained affixed to the street. Its neck was broken, but did not appear stout enough to have supported the head had it not been. The fact that movement was possible despite the obvious break in the neck was but one confusing aspect of an already unbelievable scene. Andy screamed. A black creature, long and thick like a bloated snake, coiled its slick, hot form around Andy's ankle. Its entire body was covered in stiff, ebony hair that could well have been narrow spikes. The head was merely a circular gash, which continually opened and closed with a wet, sucking sound. Andy kicked his leg out and felt the spikes dig into his skin. Teeth gripped the meat of Andy's calf, and the creature writhed as if trying to burrow into the tissue. Numbness crept up Andy's leg, and it began to buckle at the knee. The bobble-headed animal collapsed in the street and bleated like a wayward calf. Almost as if on cue, a chorus of calls erupted nearby. "Beep!" was the initial cry, followed by a dozen or so echoes of the same sound. The numbness touched the base of Andy's spine, and his vision clouded, a brown, gauzy haze separating him from whatever reality he now occupied. He pitched forward and caught himself on instinct. The cries of "beep!" were like sirens in his head, his thoughts like a dozen tadpoles in a snow globe. As his internal vision darkened, a wall of black rising before him, he felt hands crawl across his body. The determination of their grasp spoke of desperation. He heard honking, although distant, more akin to a memory.
"Hey, mister,"
a voice called from a world away. As his mind wrestled with the voice, the sustained note released and a crescendo of strings followed. The feeling returned to his leg, and his vision began to regain its former clarity. His body was unmolested, the pain and tingling absent from his leg. He realized he was standing in the street, one foot on either side of the dividing yellow hash marks. A car swerved around him.
"Mister,"
the voice said again. Andy flinched upon seeing the homeless man still utilizing the shopping cart as a walker. He drifted into the crepuscular light, broken by pulsing wings of greedy moths.
"You okay?"
Andy looked at his still shaking leg and saw evidence of nothing unusual.
I think so.
He returned to his car on mechanically clumsy legs and sat behind the steering wheel for a full minute. The homeless man lingered nearby, chewing his gums and scanning the grass for aluminum cans.
"I handed you some money, a 20, a second ago. I think it's on the sidewalk," Andy said.
He jerked the car door shut and pressed the gas pedal. The car lurched. Andy offered an apologetic wave to the homeless man without looking at him. He drove home on autopilot, accompanied by the fading music of a symphony. Andy was thankful that his work week was over. He hoped 2 days of rest might clear his head, or at least allow him time to seek out an explanation. Sleep came with great reluctance, and brought with it nightmares.
"Hi, this is Gene. If you can't reach me, I'm playing the slots. Wish me luck."
Andy cleared his throat.
"Hi, Mom. It's Andy. I was just calling to see how you're doing. Tell Pops I said hi. Call me back."
Andy hesitated before adding,
"Soon."
Andy placed the phone on the receiver and toggled the mouse, bringing the computer monitor back to life. The room was filled with natural light for the first time in weeks, despite the glare it created on the screen that held Andy's attention. It was comforting. Metallica played in the background loud enough to obscure any sounds beyond his walls. Andy had woken with the honest intention of discovering the source of his experience in the library across town. It's what they always did in movies. But the idea of driving his car and encountering another land eel, or whatever it was, robbed his will to do anything more than open the blinds and research from the comfort of his computer chair. He sipped an energy drink and began to read. Through perusing conspiracy sites and message boards, Andy managed to find a couple of topics concerning time slips. Generally, these involved accounts of encountering people or things from the wrong era. In one instance, a contributor claimed to have photographed a soldier from the American Revolution wandering around a field near his home. The soldier made eye contact with the writer and brandished his weapon in fear. With a flash, the picture was taken, and the soldier disappeared in the same instant. The image was blurry, a haggard man, half transparent, arm raised, though the weapon was not captured. Without the story, it was nothing, just an interesting story written by an anonymous author. Andy dismissed the phenomenon, or possible fabrication, and continued scrolling. A car stopped at a red light pulled his attention to the window. He sucked in air, lungs filled to aching. Beyond the car was a church, one he did not recognize, though he looked out that window every day. He willed the light to turn green or the car to give some indication that it was not frozen. How long did that light take? Andy rose from his seat in preparation. The light flashed green and the car sped away. Air seeped through his gritted teeth and he sat down. There was no church either. It was a wait-in-your-car oil change place, had been for as long as he remembered. Andy opened a thread titled, My Experience. He began to read, at first annoyed by the lack of punctuation, and then intrigued by the content.
Worked the midnight shift as a security guard because I couldn't find a job after college. And sometimes I didn't see another soul for weeks. I don't know how it got to be this way. I just drifted away from people and those things you use to define a person. And I realize I'm rambling now, but I swear there were times when I literally felt like I no longer existed.
Andy's face neared the monitor, nose grazing fine particles of dust. He scanned the text, and his heart beat faster.
I guess I slipped is the best way to describe it. I don't understand physics or any science beyond what I learned in school, but I can feel it. I can feel at the fringes of our reality, another reality bleeding through, and maybe my detachment from our reality made me sensitive to it. I don't know. The other reality is terrible. It's evil. It's a vision of hell. The things I saw didn't make sense. The sky was green like bile, and the animals, they weren't animals. They were monsters, demons. The anatomy was wrong, and it just defied logic. What's terrifying is I can't tell the difference anymore. Our worlds kind of blend together. Sometimes I sit at my post and catch a whiff of the other world. I'll see those horrible things stalking around the neighborhood, passing through houses as if they didn't exist. Sometimes I'm in the other world and I see a car drive by, oblivious. I think they watch me sleep. I have to go, but I'll write more if I can.
Andy scrolled and found nothing. A few replies, mostly insults. The thread was the author's only entry on that particular site. Andy reclined, arms hanging lifeless at his side. In the space between songs, his breathing was loud and ragged. Maybe the author experienced the same phenomenon as Andy. Maybe it was completely different, unrelated. Regardless, he either did not survive to submit an update or had not bothered to return to it for some other reason.
Beep!
Beep!
Andy bolted upright, brandishing the mouse as if it was a grenade. A second, 2 seconds passed, and the next song began. The calls came again, echoing inside Andy's mind, and he recognized at once that he had imagined them. The demarcation between his reality and what hovered near its edges grew fuzzy. The walls were too close together and the ceiling too low. Dueling urges to cower inside his closet or abandon the mausoleum of his apartment sent him pacing. He approached the front door with his arm outstretched, fingers quaking. His eyes, raw and jaundiced in appearance, glanced about the room as if each shadow had teeth. The adrenaline spike drove stomach acid up the back of his throat. He grasped the doorknob for support, turned it, and stumbled out of the living room onto the cement walkway leading to his apartment. Andy squirmed in the grass like a fish in a dwindling puddle. To a passerby, he would have appeared a drunkard who abandoned his attempt to make it home. He turned on his side, a blue haze dominating the center of his vision. Control your breathing. He braced himself with an elbow and sat, brain like a bowl of cold soup. With grunts and groans, the soup sloshing around his skull, he stood and began to walk. Andy sought refuge within the pages of a book. The air conditioning was like cool silk on his hot skin. He thumbed through a hefty paperback about cryptozoology, analyzed the various grainy pictures purporting to be one beast of legend or another. "Huh," he said. There were a few creatures with which he was familiar, including the Orang Pendek, or Short Man of Sumatra. Ape men appeared to be a phenomenon consistent across many cultures, and Andy couldn't help but consider the possibility of a kinship to his own dilemma. He saw her in his peripheral vision, taller than himself, with a disposable cup of coffee perched near her shoulder. She glanced at her watch and sighed before scanning the titles of paperbacks. Probably on her lunch break. Although he wasn't sure if it was lunch, only that it was bright outside. Clearing his throat, Andy turned his body in what he hoped appeared to be a natural fashion and chanced a more direct observation. She was quite beautiful, and the fact that she was perusing the conspiracy and occult books served to deepen the immediate attraction. More than that, it rooted him to his reality, touching that very human part of him that longed for connection. She sidestepped at a leisurely pace, closing the distance between herself and Andy. A breeze of sweet citrus and honey enveloped him. Andy recalled a crush from middle school and smiled. She hummed, cool green eyes searching the titles. When she collided with Andy, her demeanor changed from quiet contemplation to pure terror in an instant. She fell backwards onto the carpeted floor and landed awkwardly, legs pointing in opposite directions, coffee cup resting in a spreading puddle. Her petal pink lips trembled. Andy stuttered. In her eyes, he discovered the inspiration for fear. There was nothing particularly frightening about his appearance. She just hadn't seen him. At all. She'd seen open space and meant to occupy it. Andy dropped his book, held out a hand as if offering assistance, and recalled it. She shielded her face from him, and he hurried away, practically sprinting as he neared the double doors leading out of the bookstore. The world beyond the doors was not one Andy recognized. The sky was sea green and populated with tattered clouds of a similar color, though a slightly lighter hue. The air tasted different, acrid. It reminded him of the sour, phosphorus scent of the paper mill he passed on the route to school as a child. Behind him was not the bookstore, but an expanse of yellow earth interrupted here and there by tufts of grass. He saw a man there, crouched with his back to Andy. "Hey!" Andy jogged toward the figure and felt a surge of relief knowing he was not alone. "Hey!" Andy screamed and heard distant replies of, "Beep!" He stood over the man, panting, gray strands of saliva dangling from the corners of his mouth. "Hey, what are you?" Andy stopped. The man wore a black suit long out of fashion, though its era was not obvious. The clothes were dusty and tinted yellow because of it. A ribbon bow tie fluttered limply in the feeble wind. He looked up at Andy and smiled. The lone incisor, the color of aged paper, commanded Andy's attention for a moment. "My God," Andy whispered. The man's eyes were small, far too small for his head. They were practically marbles. His face was terrible. The skin was ruddy and blotched, interrupted here and there by random patches of white hair. A spiderweb of capillaries dominated either cheek, and a thin film of black fuzz covered his constantly darting tongue. He smelled like the aftermath of battle, of rot and gunpowder. The old man held a collection of animals in his hands, hairless pink things with wrinkled skin. He held them up for Andy to see. They shared his face. Each of the six rat-sized animals had the old man's face. The man placed the animals on the yellow dirt and retrieved a single specimen. He held it by the nape of the neck with maternal delicacy.
"Some of us chose to come here," the man said. His voice was like the croak of a vulture.
He sunk his single tooth into the animal's back. Blood gurgled from the wound and filled his mouth, purling from the corners in twin red streams. His Adam's apple danced as he swallowed.
"Gotta purge the weekends,"
he offered with a wink. Andy turned to run, but stopped. There was nowhere to run. He saw the hazy silhouettes of trees, cacti, and other things he couldn't identify, but there was no shelter.
"Is this hell?"
The old man wiped the blood from his cracked lips and dropped the creature onto the ground.
"Heaven, if you ask me."
There was no malice or deceit in his voice. "Why am I here?" The rat thing with the old man's face dragged its broken and bloodied body away toward a sprout of grass, mewling softly as its life bled out into the dirt. The old man secured another writhing victim between thumb and forefinger and paused to consider the question.
"Because you weren't there anymore,"
he said, and nodded toward the approximate area from which Andy had arrived.
"But I don't want to be here. What do I do? I'm not meant to be here."
With thinly veiled annoyance, the old man squinted at Andy and blinked his minuscule eyes rapidly.
"Start walking and hope. They had a thing called radios where I came from. You could tune to a station and hear another in the background sometimes. Sometimes that other station came through so clear, it sounded like the radio men were talking to each other. It's a web, you know. It's all the same place, your world and mine. You tuned out of your part of the web, and another claimed you."
"Beep!"
Andy, startled, spun around.
"Oh, don't worry about them. Those bastards are delicious."
The old man began to stroke the yellowed beard of his rodent counterpart.
"But don't let them catch you sleeping."
That was Gehenna by L.P. Hernandez. L.P. Hernandez is an author of horror and speculative fiction. His stories have been featured in anthologies from Cemetery Dance, Dark Matter Inc., and The Howl Society, among others. He is a regular contributor to the No Sleep podcast and has released 4 short story collections. His novella, Stargazers, kicked off the My Dark Library line of novellas curated by Sadie Mother Horror Hartman and published through Cemetery Gates Media. LP also hosts Dog-Eared Nightmares, a podcast about well-loved horror. When not writing, LP serves as a medical administrator in the U.S. Air Force. He is a husband, father, and a dedicated metalhead. Well, I'd say that wraps things up for tonight's episode. I hope you've enjoyed this sampler of L.P. Hernandez's work, and I'll remind you that you can get his collection, Dreadful, Tales of the Dead and Dying, over at Amazon. L.P., thanks for the stories. That's it until next week, friends. Be sure to come back for more Horror Hill, and in the meantime, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot, and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron?
you'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.